This is Laura Dierda with the Becker's Payer Issues Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Dr. Charles Rosen, Medical Director in the Department of Contracting and Payer Relations at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, as well as a professor of surgery in the Transplantation Division. Dr. Rosen, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you, Laura. I'm happy to be here.
Before we dive into the questions, could you tell us a little bit more about yourself and your background?
Sure. I'm a transplant surgeon. I do predominantly liver transplantation as my clinical practice. I did all my training at Mayo Clinic, starting in medical school, my residency, my transplant fellowship. I actually left twice and came back twice, and I've been back on staff at Mayo Clinic in Rochester since 1998. I returned to be the surgical director of our liver transplant program and served in that role for about 10 years. At Mayo Clinic, we rotate leadership positions, and after that, I had a year off, and then I became the division chair. And while I was the division chair, I got involved with our Department of Contracting and Payer Relations. They were in need of an associate medical director for Mayo Clinic Rochester and our health system. Our medical director was at Mayo Clinic Florida, and we had another associate medical director in Arizona. And after serving in that role for 2 years, I then became the medical director for the enterprise, and while I was the medical director, I've been very much involved in our direct-to-employer relationships, our specialty care contracts, and in particular, our complex care program. I still continue to practice as a transplant surgeon, doing liver transplantation, both deceased and living donor procedures.
Fascinating. And, I think it's really interesting how Mayo Clinic has things set up in terms of having a clinical person matched up in the Department of Contracting and Payer Relations. I think, especially for health systems, that this is an emerging area. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the structure there at Mayo and how you came to be in the role that you're in.
Sure. At Mayo Clinic, all of our clinical leadership are people have an administrative partner. So when I was the division chair for transplantation surgery, I had an administrative partner. I served briefly for a period of time as our transplant center director, in which case I also had another administrative partner. And we tend to go through our leadership roles every 4 to 8 years. There's a natural rotation that we have. And so we're not expected to serve for many, many years in a given position. In contracting and payer relations, that's not a clinical department, it's an administrative department. So I'm kind of the physician adjunct to that group and serve as to help facilitate discussions between the medical staff and our medical leaders and the contracting and payer relations program. And also when we're working with employers and payers, I'll be involved with those discussions, particularly when other medical directors from the insurance companies or the employers are present. I actually became involved with contracting and payer relations because transplantation, as many people would know, is highly leveraged with contracts, and particularly specialty care contracts and centers of excellence networks. So while I was serving as the surgical director of our liver transplant program and then as division chair, I was always intimately involved in those discussions about network participation, and one thing led to another, and I was working well and getting along well with our colleagues in contracting and payer relations, and so they asked me to join as an associate medical director and then as the medical director. Our contracting and payer relations department serves all of Mayo Clinic Rochester, Mayo Clinic Florida, Mayo Clinic Arizona, and our Mayo Clinic health system in southwest Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin.
Fantastic. Well, I'm really excited to talk to you today and explore more about what Mayo's doing. I'm wondering, what are your conversations with payers like today compared to a year ago or a few years ago prior to the pandemic? And I'd love to hear the same, from your perspective as well for the employers that you're talking to, since I know that's a big part of what you do.
Well, obviously, the past year, we've all been affected by COVID, and particularly in the contracting and payer relations. Many of employers and even the centers of excellence networks that are commercial have had limitations due to travel prohibition or difficulty traveling or even difficulty administering benefits when the patients can't take advantage of them. So that's played a big role in our discussions. The other thing that's new is that almost all of our conversations are via the telephone. our video conferencing calls. And in the past, we used to visit one another so that we'd have face-to-face meetings. In a way, the virtual conversations are a little bit better. You don't get to know people as well or have dinner with them or to talk outside of the meeting. But the meetings can be scheduled very quickly. We don't have to make travel arrangements, and we can fit them in during our normal workday. So in one way, the virtual conversations have been much better than face-to-face. But to be honest, I still miss the face-to-face interactions, particularly when we have time and to go off topic and talk about other things that might be of mutual interest.
Absolutely. I think all of us are missing some of that connection that we typically have in person versus over the video conferencing, you know, even though that's the best we've been able to do over the past year. And I'm wondering, do you think at all that impacts or affects the way that you're able to do your contracts, or is it more of just the human-to-human aspect of comfort level and being able to connect with each other?
Well, the human-to-human or face-to-face interaction is very important. And for people that we already know, that we've already worked with for many years, the video conferencing works really, really well. For people that are new, it kind of takes some getting used to. And, you know, you can't be certain that what people are, how they're reacting to what we're saying, or if they, you know, look like they have a question, you might not be able to see it on a virtual conference, whereas if you're face-to-face, it might be easier to do that. Or if they like what you're saying, you might be able to react to it. Or if they dislike what you're saying, you might be able to change the conversation. So it's a little more difficult with that. But by and large, the convenience is tremendous.
That's good to hear. Now, what are your top two or three challenges that you anticipate will be on the horizon in the next 12 months or so?
Well, COVID has just absolutely jump-started virtual care. And virtual care is here to stay. The COVID just, you know, we had to do it during the pandemic. And now that people see the advantages of it, I think it's here to stay. So in the future, we'll be looking from a primary care standpoint at people communicating with their caregivers, physicians, nurses through applications in addition to virtual consultations or virtual visits. In specialty and complex care, there'll be a big need for virtual consultations prior to patients traveling to a distant center to receive the care that's needed at that specific center. And it's not become a request, it's almost become an expectation in our conversations already. The one specialty or the one clinical practice that will really benefit, and there is a tremendous need for it, is virtual care for behavioral health and for chemical dependency treatment. And I think we'll see a big growth in that as well.
Got it. It's so interesting to think about, you know, how virtual care is really changing the way that healthcare delivery is designed, quite frankly. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, both as a clinician and then, you know, from your conversations with payers, do you anticipate this will be disruptive in terms of the financial side of making more virtual care work? Or does it seem like insurance companies, employers or whatnot understand, you know, what the value of that virtual care is and want to make sure that, you know, you're able to deliver it, but also have a financially stable organization?
Right. I think, you know, the reimbursement models still need to be worked out. Obviously, there aren't the costs associated with running the clinic, the desk staff, the nursing staff, the custodial staff, just to have people come in and out of examining rooms to see physicians and other providers. However, from a business standpoint and from more importantly, from a clinical standpoint, it also means a lot of the tests and imaging studies will be done at home and not at the center that the specialist is practicing at. And that can be problematic, particularly when we're looking at high-resolution imaging studies, which are specifically geared to the question that the clinician wants to ask. And so my area of interest, for instance, is hilar cholangiocarcinoma or bile duct tumors that arise in the central portion of the liver. And imaging is absolutely critical to our decision-making as to whether or not we operate and take out a tumor such as a cholangiocarcinoma, or we can't operate and take it out and we have to do a liver transplant instead. And so there's always the potential, if those studies aren't done right, that then they have to be repeated when the patient would come to the specialty care or the complex care center, or if they're not repeated, to make sure that we avoid making a mistake and not seeing something that we would have liked to seen before we do an operation. So the clinical importance and how that those imaging studies are done is really important. From a business standpoint, it also means that the providing center, would not get the revenue from that testing and those imaging studies, or they might have to repeat them because they're inadequate.
Got it. That makes sense. And obviously, it'll be interesting to see, you know, how health systems navigate that in the future. I wanted to ask you as well about value-based care and some of the risk-based contracting that's becoming more prevalent, over the past year, and really many see as being accelerating in the future. How is your approach to value-based care evolving?
Well, I have a pretty strong opinion on what we should consider value when we're providing care to patients. And oftentimes it's linked to the reimbursement model. Thinking that if the physicians or the providers are at some risk, that they'll do a better job. They'll either be more efficient or they'll, do the operation better because they only get paid a certain amount regardless of whether or not there's complications and that sort of thing. And I look at value different than that. I look at three things that really determine the value of care. I call it the three R's. Three rights. Number one, you have to get the diagnosis right. If the diagnosis is incorrect and you treat the wrong thing, it doesn't matter how efficient the treatment is, it doesn't matter how good the treatment is, or if it's an operation, how well that operation is done. If it's done for the wrong reason, everything's a waste, and even more importantly, potentially dangerous to the patient because they suffer the complications of the treatment that's ineffective and their underlying disease is going untreated. So that's of first importance to me. Second is doing the right thing. As physicians, we oftentimes have choices in what type of procedure we're going to do or what type of treatment to do. If we're treating a cancer, do we treat it first with chemotherapy and then radiation therapy? Do we operate first? What's the appropriate order? If we're seeing somebody with back pain, do we do a back operation right off the bat, or do we try conservative measures first? And unfortunately, with all the reimbursement models in place, they all have the potential to provide incentives for doing what's best for the person that's sending out the bill. And, I'm very fortunate to practice at Mayo Clinic where where I'm on a straight salary, as are all my colleagues. I do almost exclusively liver transplantation, but I have the same salary regardless of how many liver transplants I do in a given year. It is an expectation, however, that I'll do always what I think is best. The third R is doing it right. When one has to do an operation or procedure or provide a treatment, there has to be some excellence such that the best possible outcome can be achieved. At Mayo Clinic, we're under peer pressure to do the right thing, particularly for surgeons in our procedural practice, because our colleagues keep an eye on us to make sure that we're doing the best for our patients. But right now, with reimbursement is largely fee-for-service, we get paid for doing it. When we look at most of the value-based reimbursement models, we get paid for doing it right. But there's nothing in those reimbursement models that takes into account whether or not we did the right thing, or more importantly, whether or not we even got the diagnosis right. And so to me, those two bullet points are equally important when one determines, what's high value in medical care.
Absolutely. I think that's a really important distinction, and so interesting to kind of mull over all of the different areas of care and things that have to be done and decisions that have to be made outside of necessarily the cost considerations, and then having everything go right too. It just really brings into a clear picture of what the incentives are and where patient care needs to go.
Yes, and I could give you innumerable examples of how a misdiagnosis is wasteful and potentially dangerous for a patient, how inappropriate choice of what type of therapy or how aggressive the therapy should be, which potentially could be due to financial incentives. And thirdly, of course, everybody knows, excellence in the procedural practice or in the treatment of a disease is very important as well. But those first two bullet points are, for me, of paramount importance.
Absolutely. Now, as we wrap up our conversation, I have one more question for you. What are you excited about for the future?
Well, I am excited that at some point that we will recognize value for true value, which I think includes the three things about getting the diagnosis right, doing the right thing in addition to doing it right. I think that in our discussions with payers, employers, and how we help each other deliver the best possible care to our patients, our ideas will be able to move faster now that we can do things, a lot of things virtually, and we will not need to travel to do business. I think that systems and business plans and technology will enable us to provide better direction for patients that are in need of specialty and complex care, and to help those patients identify where the best place is for them to go. I'm looking forward to having increased efficiency in our patient workups. I unfortunately encounter many patients where they knew they had a tumor, but by the time they got to me, it's just too late and the tumor grew out of a treatable criteria. And that once we, decide what to do for patients, that we can provide that care in a timely fashion.
Dr. Rosen, thank you so much for being here today. This has been a really fascinating discussion, and I look forward to connecting with you again in the future.
I will as well, and thank you for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
Sometimes people need more help, but they're hard to find, reach, treat. OnTrack delivers behavioral health care. We reach the hard to reach, up to 52 weeks of care. That's durable. OnTrack delivers behavioral health care. We reach the hard to reach, up to 52 weeks of care. With a 3x program ROI, members get a return to health. Health plans get a return on investment. Help is here. OnTrack. Better together.